Moncrief on News Talk.
Now, it's time for a new thing. We're going to call this Moncrief's Murder Club. Every Wednesday, Cassie Delaney will be coming in to us to share some heinous but unusual crimes. They won't all be murders, by the way, but we just like the name. Cassie, good afternoon.
How are you, Sean?
So, Carol Sue Elvaker, is that how you...
Elvaker, yes. Yeah. This is a mad story, right? Yeah. And what you'll learn in a lot of these stories that I come in to tell you is they often originate, start, or kind of just perpetuate in America, the land of the free, home of the mad.
Yeah.
So, this story, we're going back to 2001. This is kind of just a mad story of family drama, a board games night gone completely wrong. We're in Minoco, Oklahoma, which is a small town of about 1,400 people. Very, very small. And it's one of those kind of little small towns. Everybody knows everybody. Everybody knows everybody's business. I will say off the top, this is obviously a tragic case. A lot of these stories are tragic, but they have just these mad, weird elements in it. So here is where we start. We're in February 2001. Police come in and find a man called Brian Roach, who's 34, at home, dead in his bed. He'd been stabbed once in the chest. First, looks like a classic and domestic dispute. Maybe has gone wrong. Something untoward has happened. But it emerges that the main suspect is his mother-in-law, Carol Sue Elvaker, who's 53 at the time. And she says to the investigators that a Ouija board made her do it.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Did she give any details as to who was communicating with her through the Ouija
board? None of that. None of that. So it's kind of a case of, is this just a creative defence, or did she really believe that her son-in-law was evil? I'm sure there's plenty of mother-in-laws who believe their son-in-laws are evil, but she really acted on it. So according to the case, Brian was asleep while Carol and her daughter Tammy and Tammy's two daughters, so a real, like, you know, intergenerational family board game night here, were using a Ouija board up in the attic. And Carol got a message to indicate that Brian Roach was evil and therefore needed to die. So she goes in, down from the attic, into Brian's room and stabs him in the chest while he's asleep, and he dies.
Right.
Absolutely tragic.
Now, the daughter she's playing the Ouija board, was she married to Brian Roach?
Yeah, at the time. And there was no signs of there being any sort of like domestic disputes behind the scenes. There was no signs of abuse there. This came totally out of the blue in a very, very small town. So everyone's completely shocked. And after the stabbing, it kind of got even weirder. So Tammy starts assisting her mother, gets a getaway vehicle together, and together Carol, Tammy, and the two teenagers who were doing the Ouija board all hop in a car, and off they drive down the northeast towards Tulsa on the 44th Interstate. At some point, Carol then crashes the car and breaks both her ankles.
Oh,
okay?
God.
But as it gets weirder, She, despite breaking both her ankles, she decides to run from the scene. And then she removed all her clothes, jumped into the highway barrier, and then ran into a wooded area just north of the interstate, where police eventually found her there hiding.
Is there any explanation why she felt the need to remove all her clothes?
Maybe she was just overheating. I'm sure the adrenaline would do wonders to your body, you know? Madness. So she was taken away then to a health sciences centre for treatment. But the interesting thing about Carol is, at 53 years of age, she had no previous instance of mental health illness. She had no signs of any violence before. Like I said, there had been no indications there was anything wrong at home prior to this instance. It just was totally out of the blue, somewhat prompted by the use of this Ouija board.
Yeah, I you can't help but wonder, if they're up in the attic and she gets a message to go down and kill her son-in-law, does her daughter say, no, ma'am, don't kill the son-in-law, or maybe this was a good idea?
I mean, maybe they were in cahoots, I don't know, but it seemed like Tammy was pretty much on board with the plan. The fact that she was then arrested as an accessory to murder because she had gotten the getaway vehicle and gone on the run with her mom. I don't know what her plan was. And the thing was, Brian was quite a respected member of the community. At 19 years of age, he was actually elected the town mayor. So he had a good standing in the community, which made it even more tragic because he was known to everybody. I mean, very small town, but a really well-known and well-regarded man. So a very, very strange case.
Did they find evidence of mental illness with
Carol
no,
Sue?
So she they hadn't had any history of mental illness, no signs of drug or alcohol use. They weren't able to find any domestic strife within the Roach household at all. And I think that's what makes this story so unsettling, is because generally before a crime, you'd have indicators. Not that people walk around with signs saying, I'm going to turn into the villain. But there's generally signs you would spot in murderers. It's the kind of not being nice to animals when you're younger, or levels of like some sort of mental distress or any signs. But there was none here. This was completely, completely out of the blue. Now, there are some sort of psychological effects that can happen when you're using a Ouija board. You have these involuntary kind of slight muscle spasms when you're doing it intense that people often confuse for messages from the afterlife. But I think if Carol felt the Ouija board was telling her that she had to kill Brian, she maybe believed that deep down somewhere, that that's something she wanted to do.
And what happened to her?
So she was sentenced. So she got... She was found guilty of murder. It was a kind of open and shut case and sentence. But what's interesting is it's not the first time a Ouija board has been used in defence or brought up in court as kind of a creative defence mechanism. In the 1930s, there was a woman called Nancy Bowen who said that a Ouija board advised her to kill her neighbour after a Ouija board told her that she had killed the deceased husband. So it's quite common.
Yeah. I wonder, is it like she goes to a lawyer and the lawyer says Ouija board defense? That's a good one. We can use that.
Yeah. I mean, I think the thing to remember here is that like a Ouija board, we would think of a Ouija board as like sort of a window into paranormal activity. But actually in courtroom, it's a window into someone's mental state. Like it is used. It's not, unfortunately, it's not a defense that stands up in court. You can't prosecute, you know, the paranormal. So even if someone did strongly encourage her to do it, she unfortunately was the one yielding the knife and found ultimately guilty of killing poor Brian Roach.
And the daughter, Tammy,
she was found guilty of accessory to murder. Yeah. And the two teenagers placed off in care.
Oh, God. And are they still in prison?
They are. Well, this was 2001, so Carol is still in prison, I believe. Yeah.
Yeah. I wonder if she's using Ouija boards in there.
I would say you only make that mistake once.
Yeah. Now, our second case is more, this is more of a con woman.
Yeah.
I suppose it begs the question, why was she conning people? And then she was conning people in maybe the sickest way.
This is really sad, but this is, again, something that we see quite frequently in cons, especially cons where there's a female con artist at the centre. There's usually no sign of what the motivation is. It's not for monetary gain. It's not like one of those classic, you know, multi-level marketing scams where at least there's a financial benefit at the end. This story is so tragic. So we are talking about Tanya Head, who was a Spanish woman who for years and years and years presented herself as a survivor of 9/11. And the thing about it is her story was not just tragic, it was almost perfect. She had all these elements to her tale that made her a very well-known survivor. Not only was she a survivor and someone who then took up space in media and interviews and like taking up space that should have rightfully gone to actual survivors, she rose up to become the president of a survivor support network. So she was constantly in rooms talking to real people and pertaining that these instances had happened to her. So Tanya Head was a Spanish woman from Barcelona, and she came into the orbit of the World Trade Center Survivors Network, a support group in the aftermath of 9/11. And this is the support group that she became president and spokesperson for.
And did she have a detailed story about where she was on 9/11?
So her story is like a screenplay. It was absolutely incredible. She claimed that she was in the South Tower on 9/11, specifically up around the 19th floor, which would have put her as like one of like less than 20 people who were that kind of that far up and who had survived. So she described herself as waiting near the express elevators, caught up in chaos. Her story was also had like an element of romance, because she said her fiancé Dave, doing inverted commas, was in the other tower and he had tragically passed away. And then like just as if this was made for the screen, she had this detail in the story of when she was running to try and find survival, you know, try to find safety. She came across a man who was squashed and dying, and he handed her his engagement ring to give to his wife as a parting gift. So, I mean, she's touching on all these incredibly emotional moments. And that, I think, is the problem with her story, is that like in a trauma like this, your memory is kind of scattered and you don't really remember the details. But she had this really punctuated, well thought out, well rounded story about her survival of the of obviously such trauma and such a tragedy. And it's, I think what's really interesting is just how easily she was able to get away with this for so long, because people want to believe it. You know,
yes,
people want
course,
to find
yeah.
solace in stories like that.
Yeah. And so how was she found out?
So in 2007, reporters started trying to verify elements of her story. And this is where the kind of it started to unravel. I think if reporters were going into it thinking that this was a great survival story and they maybe wanted to cover it, and it probably would have been adapted into a screenplay. But in the verification of elements of the story, like trying to find this Brian character, like trying to place her in the World Trade Center for a job for any real reason, or just trying to place where she was, they couldn't find any verification. And they quickly realized that she wasn't just not in the World Trade Center that day. She wasn't in New York. She was still in Barcelona studying business in college. So she wasn't even in the vicinity of the tragedy. And as this sort of kind of unraveled, NPR did a fantastic piece, and there was a documentary in 2012 about her con and how it had all unraveled. And so very, very quickly, she was removed from kind of all the survivors network, and she was removed from her leadership positions. But she was in those positions for a really long time before this was uncovered.
Had she broken any laws, though? I mean, she told lies and it was tasteless and awful.
This is the thing with con artists. It's often really hard to get them on anything legal. I mean, you've got the likes of Tanya Head here, Belle Gibson, you know, Samantha Azzopardi, who you'll remember from outside the GPO during a very local con here. They very often are doing these cons kind of for, I don't know whether it's a sense of belonging or attention or, you know, some sort of publicity. Like I said, very rarely is it financial gain. So there's no fraud taking place. I think you can only really capture people on these kind of cons when they are stealing someone's identity. But more often than not, they're in and out of prison. Samantha Azzopardi has popped in and out of prison for a rake of different things before she was eventually pinned down with kidnapping kids in Australia.
Yeah. And so Alicia Head... Was she ejected from the country? Where is she now?
She was ejected from the country. So after the story unraveled and after her cons were kind of revealed, she pretty much disappeared from public life. There was a lot of rumours that she had passed away, but they were just more misinformation as part of this whole story. So it's not much is known about where she is now or what she's up to. But that seems to be her one kind of major con, where you do have a couple of people like Belle Gibson who might pop up with a few here and there.
Yeah, but no one's able to pin her down and say, why did you do this?
No, yeah. We've never gotten an explanation for this. I suppose when you think about these things and you want to try and make sense of cons like this, it really is just that someone places themselves in a tragedy for a sense of purpose and belonging or meaning, but they just kind of like co-opt someone else's tragedy to give themselves a place to belong. I don't know. It's really sad if you think about it too much.
Yeah. And Dave, the supposed fiancé,
was
there a Dave?
Never existed.
No, Dave.
Oh,
no, she wasn't even engaged. So sad.
No.
Cassie Delaney, thanks a million.
Thank you.
Moncrief, weekdays at 2. On News Talk. Conversation that counts.